did that snow go? Brad, I thought we were supposed to get like another, you know, son of Snowmageddon today. That went away.
Surprise, surprise, they were wrong.
They were wrong. Okay. I'm gonna give them a mulligan on that. I'm happy about that, actually. I was not looking forward to, although I'm looking outside my window here and I'm seeing stuff coming out of the sky, so maybe I'm speaking a little bit too early, but hopefully it's not going to be what we were talking about before. Hey, but a little bit of breaking news before we get into the stuff we have on the show today. We've been following what's been going on in the 8th Congressional District as we reported this weekend and we live streamed on the Uptake. There was a convention of the DFL delegates up there. They decided not to endorse anybody because nobody got to 60%. Well, the person who was getting the most votes from the delegates, Leah Pfeiffer, has decided that she's not going to continue on into the primary. So that brings us down to just four people running: Jason Metza, Joe Radinovich, Michelle Lee, and Kirsten Hagan Kennedy. A couple quotes here from Leah Pfeiffer. She says, "Without DFL party resources, I can't keep asking my supporters to keep sacrificing for this campaign, although I know no doubt that you would." She said, "A divisive primary season would only serve to weaken the party and distract from the issues affecting the people of the 8th Congressional District." So there you go. One of the candidates who had the most support among delegates, but probably was not in the strongest position to run a primary campaign. Leah Pfeiffer pulling out, leaving just four running for the August primary. And the winner of that is likely to face the Republican Joe Stauber. That is a course of interest because it's an open seat. Representative Rick Nolan is retiring. Now, on to what's happening down here in the Twin Cities today. We had a big rally at the state capitol. Again, we've been through this issue before. This is asking for, you know, universal background checks, red flag laws that would keep the guns out of hands of people who might hurt a loved one. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Fry was there, one of the people at the Capitol Rotunda today. He called on students and adults at the Capitol to take aim at those preventing change.
"You quite literally are the NRA's worst nightmare. You're the NRA's worst nightmare because it is your voices, it is your stories, it is your advocacy that's ultimately going to make the difference. It is your voices that are going to change minds, that are going to change hearts, and ultimately that are going to save lives. And if your legislators do not act when you march to the Capitol, we will be there when you march to the ballot box and to the polls. We're going to make this happen. We're going to save lives. And we're going to do it together. Thank you so much."
Now, that was, of course, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Fry speaking to a rally down at the state capitol. Joining me right now is Jerry Mathewick, who is with the Center for Homicide Research. He was down at the capitol as well. Jeffrey, you got to listen to the mayor today. What did you think of what he was saying?
Well, frankly, I thought the mayor did a phenomenal job. He addressed a lot of important concerns that people had, and I think that the mayor is going to be a really important ally in the fight against gun homicides.
Now, the bills that the legislature is or is not considering, and that's part of the point here today, I think Representative Dave Pinto was very disappointed that they did not include the bipartisan gun violence prevention measures in the bill that he was in the omnibus public safety bill, which is the big bill that gets passed on these issues. He was upset about that. And in there, there were several provisions that we just talked about: universal background checks, a red flag law that would keep guns out of the hands of people who might hurt themselves or a loved one. These are all things that are aimed, or at least the background checks, and this has been talked about, a way of trying to prevent mass shootings. That's why this has all gotten attention. But before we got on the air, we were talking about that mass shootings are only a part of the puzzle here. Explain to me what you know about that.
Yeah, so mass shootings are incredibly rare instances. And unfortunately, we classify those as high-impact, low-frequency events. And what that means is that they don't happen often, but when they do happen, they get a lot of media attention. Okay? Unfortunately, your standard typical profile of a homicide is going to be a young African-American man killing another young African-American man, likely in a city, and they know one another. And again, that's more for sociological reasons, you know, issues relating to systemic racism and other things that really just put down minority communities and make life much more difficult for them. And, you know, as a result, maybe they get involved in gangs or they have to settle disputes with violence. And when they have the ability to acquire a firearm, it becomes that much easier to commit a homicide. And we know that 2/3 of all homicides are committed with firearms. And so when we take away the firearm, what we see is less homicide.
So when we're talking about this, when we're talking about background checks, and we'll get into those other laws too, but let's just take universal background checks here for a moment. Is that going to have an impact on mass shootings? The Republicans don't think it will. Would it have an impact on what you're just talking about now, standard homicides?
Well, I think that it's a step in the right direction. I really do. I think that doing anything to prevent gun violence has the potential to prevent gun violence. You know, yeah. And by that, what I mean is that doing something is always better than doing nothing. Now, what I currently see is a lot of talking points and a lot of, oh, well, we'll focus on this one thing and that'll help solve the issue and then we can stop talking about it. And we really can't do that. We need to be talking about a lot of these underlying sociological issues that contribute to homicide. We need these more robust packages of bills that will do more than just a criminal background check system. You know, we need an assault weapons ban. We need, you know, new legislation that prevents the use of 3D printers to produce firearms parts, which currently there are no laws on the books for that. And there have been instances of mass shootings where people who could not actually acquire a firearm created their own, either through 3D printing or through purchasing the parts online and essentially building their own firearm, as crazy as that sounds.
As I mentioned, you're with the Center for Homicide Research, and so obviously you've got a lot of statistics on what happens here. And you pay attention to what is true and what is not. We were chatting before the show, and you mentioned that there's a lot of myths about active shooters out there. Tell me what some of those myths are and how they're not true.
Sure. So a lot of individuals think that mass shootings are on the rise, and that's not true. Mass shootings have actually stayed pretty consistent in frequency since the 1960s. Mm-hmm. Now, mass shootings are becoming more lethal. And by that, I mean more people are dying in mass shooting incidents. One of the reasons that we believe that is that these active shooters are learning from one another. And so after Virginia Tech, the offender locked the doors with chains so that people couldn't escape. Afterwards, we started seeing a lot more offenders thinking about how am I going to prevent these people from getting out. And so we need to be thinking about how can we prevent those active shooters from learning from one another? And one thing that we can do is the No Notoriety campaign, where different news organizations do not name the offender or show the offender's face. You take away that fame element. And so that's an incredibly important component of mass shooting prevention. Okay. Another myth is that a lot of these individuals have mental health issues. Okay. First, I'd like to say, well, what is mental health? Are we talking about depression? Are we talking about autism? And depending on how you classify it, what we see is that only 13 to 28% of these active shooters have some form of mental illness. And, you know, you can say, well, 28%, that's a large number. Well, yeah, but 72% of these individuals do not have some type of mental illness. And so to focus exclusively on mental health is not going to prevent the majority of these mass shootings. Another thing that people sort of misidentify is that your standard mass shooting is a public incident, and you know, maybe a mall shooter or a high school shooter. And in reality, what 2/3 of all mass shootings are family annihilator cases in which typically the dad will kill the mom and the kids. That's your standard mass shooting. But because those types of mass shootings do not get as much publicity and are not as salacious as your mall shooting, because they don't affect strangers and people are worried about their own security as opposed to the security of others, you don't hear about them as often. But those are your more standard types of mass shootings. And a lot of times these dads, they get their firearms legally. And so we need to do more than just say, oh, well, you know, we're going to just ban certain guns and focus on mental health. You know, it's an incredibly complex issue that really cannot be solved with just, you know, a two-answer solution. And, you know, pick one answer and one of them is on the right side.
I think we've had this conversation with a lot of people before, is that there are a lot of moving parts in this problem. Everything from, as we've mentioned, mental health to the availability of guns to changing attitudes about violence. And, you know, you can get a lot of things that feed into this. So I guess the question is, where do you start? Because I think what people are looking for is, okay, we can't solve everything with one law, but can we start someplace that's going to at least to reverse what's going on? What are your thoughts on that?
Excellent question. So, you know, depending on who you ask, some people might say we need to focus on education. Other people might say that we need to focus on poverty. For me, I think that we need to focus on the guns. And the reason I say that is that we know that increased accessibility to firearms increases homicide rates. And that's just a fact. And so when we make it more difficult for people to acquire firearms who might be at risk of suiciding or hurting someone else, when we do that, we are making it that much more difficult for that person to commit a homicide. And so I'd say that we start there. You know, of course, a lot of things are happening at once, so we can focus on education and poverty all at the same time. But I would really say that common sense gun reforms are square one for homicide prevention.
We're speaking with Jerry Mathewig. He's with the Center for Homicide Research. Let me just go back to that thought for a moment, though. If the guns, the accessibility to guns is the problem. Isn't that a little bit of a case of the horse being out of the barn? Because the United States has more guns per person than any other country in the world, and they tend to be concentrated in a small number of hands. Is that a problem? Is that an issue that can be even tackled by trying to restrict strict access, or the fact that it's just a small number of people that have all these guns is a good thing, and maybe we can focus on the rest of the folks not getting them?
I'd say that the fact that a small percentage of the population has such a large amount of guns is a good thing for homicide prevention, because, you know, the classic argument being, oh, well, if you can't legally acquire a firearm, you're just going to find someone that can get it for you, or you're going to purchase it illegally on the black market. But in reality, people don't know how to do that. They don't know how to just go to the black market and purchase a firearm. And when you create those barriers for those people to get the firearms, it becomes that much more difficult for them to go through the hoops and actually get that firearm. And so I guess, if you absolutely wanted to, you could drive all the way down to Mississippi, where they have hardly any laws for firearms, find someone, say, hey, I'm trying to purchase a firearm. Can you get it for me? And have them get it for you. But the reality is that most people are not going to do that. You know, a lot of times individuals who commit homicides, they are killing someone who is within their immediate network, if you will. You know, their friends, their family. And they're getting their firearms from their current location. So if you live in Minneapolis, you're most likely going to find a firearm in Minneapolis. And if you have those laws that really prevent that person from acquiring a firearm, you are going to see those decreases in homicide rates. Homicide rates are incredibly high in the South, and a big part of that is that, well, you can just go to the store and pick up a firearm, and it's just that easy. If you have more restrictive gun laws, you see typically lower homicide rates. And, of course, there are exceptions. You know, the South Side of Chicago is consistently used as the exception, but in research there's always exceptions. And we can't look at outliers and say, well, you know, that's reality. You know, those are just outliers.
Now, I know you're very focused on the statistics and the numbers here with shootings and with homicides. But let me ask you about the politics here just for a moment, and then we got to wrap up.
Sure.
Today's rally was very much about politics. It was Mayor Fry basically saying the NRA has prevented anything from happening here at the state level, and the only way that we're going to solve this is marching to the ballot box. Do you agree with that statement, or is there another way to deal with this?
Well, I guess I'd say that you can't get a lot done with a House and a Senate that are opposed to common sense gun laws. You just can't. And so I would agree with him to an extent that, yeah, we need to let our voices be heard at the ballot box so that it is easier to get things done. Now, with that said, you've got great nonprofits like the Center for Homicide Research that are working on this topic regardless of who's in the House or who's in the Senate or who the governor is. And we continue to push forward and work to find solutions. And there's other nonprofits out there like us who are doing their best to solve some of those systemic issues that I just got done talking about. And so I'd say that regardless of who's in the House or the Senate, there are great nonprofits that are still getting a lot of the work done.
All right. Jerry Mathewick is with the Center for Homicide Research. I appreciate your time today on this, and thanks for checking in with us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Coming up next, do you think all veterans are upset with the Veterans Administration over health care? Not so, and they don't want it privatized. We'll hear about that next year on the Mike McEntee Show.
Hi, this is Gregory Rich from Habitation Furnishing and Design, and I'd like you to tune in to a new program, Drink in the Style. Sundays at 5 p.m., Drink in the Style is going to be a one-hour conversation about interior design and aesthetics, all while enjoying a cocktail created by a local mixologist. Drink in the Style, Sundays at 5 p.m., brought to you by Habitation Furnishing and Design.
With spring, it's car wash season. Thank goodness for the Luther Advantage program from Rudy Luther Toyota. Not only do I save 10 cents off per gallon of gas at holiday station stores, but I also get big discounts on car washes. And with free 2 years of maintenance with every new Toyota purchased, I can get my oil change and spring service done with the best service and maintenance department at Rudy Luther Toyota. Clear your spring checklist with great service from Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169.
This is Dan Brooks, Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor with RBC Wealth Management. For the past 19 years, I've been managing wealth for individuals, institutions, and corporate retirement plan sponsors. Throughout my career, I have seen common traits in successful investors. They include the courage to be diversified, the willingness to work with a professional, the discipline to follow a plan, and patience. I welcome the opportunity to help contribute to your financial success. Call me at 612-371-2396.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. The Veterans Administration is tasked with providing health care to those who have served our country in the military. Now, over the past few years, it's been documented that there are problems with the system, and veterans are fearful that the Trump administration may try to privatize it as a way of trying to fix the problem. Joining me to discuss that is David Cooley. He's a Vietnam veteran and a member of Veterans for Peace. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Glad to be here.
First off, thank you for your service to your country. You said that you served in the Navy during the Vietnam War. Tell me about your experience with the Veterans Administration.
Well, I've been primarily I stayed away from the Veterans Administration for decades and finally started using the VA in 2012. I am rated as 90% service-connected, and I am, for the most part, I am really thrilled and happy with my care at the VA. It compares equally well to the private care that I've had over the years, and I would recommend it to any veteran. Actually, I'd recommend it to anybody out there in the private sector if they could get it.
And that sounds very different from what we hear, you know, from the media reports. I'm quoting USA Today. They say more than 700,000 vets are waiting longer than a month for medical appointments. They haven't been able to hire and retain enough medical workers, and 35,000 positions are open. But you say it works pretty well, and the people that you talk to, your fellow veterans, say the same thing.
Yes, they do. Actually, if you were to find the polls of veterans within the last year, set between 70% and 80% of the veterans who use the VA healthcare system are satisfied with their care at the VA. And I have found wait times to be no longer and sometimes shorter than private care when I've used private care. And when I go out there on a rare occasion when I've had to use the choice program for something that was instituted in 2014 by Congress, which allows a veteran to go out into the community and utilize private care for a service. When I've utilized that, I've had at least as long or longer wait times, and typically private care goofs up on the billing, and consequently I'm getting bills for something that a year and a half later that I had no business being billed for. It was a VA-authorized care. So it ends up being a situation where you have an independent contractor in between the VA and the private care. They're the first people who create some issues within the system. And then secondly, the private care, they oftentimes don't do the paperwork correctly. And I've actually been told by a private care biller who was trying to bill me for that year and a half old appointment for over $1,000. They told me that before the choice program was instituted in 2014, when the VA already did 20 some percent of its patient care out in private care, that they received their payments and had less problems than they do with the current choice program.
So you have problems, or you say there are problems with the privatization, or when we use private care. The term privatization gets tossed around. The Trump administration, at least recently, has been saying, no, we're not doing that. In fact, the guy who's going to be put in charge of the VA, Ronny Jackson, is saying that, or at least he's told Congress that he will oppose privatization, and he's told the president that he opposes to privatization. Do you believe that that's the case, that he's opposed to that, and that President Trump ultimately does not want to privatize the Veterans Administration, or do you believe differently?
I believe differently, Mike. It is the president, people in his cabinet, and people in Congress, some of them on both sides of the aisle, but primarily on one side of the aisle, who are interested in privatization. Of course, they're being pushed by other forces outside also that stand to make a lot of money on it. But when they talk about the whole notion of privatizing, they say we're not going to privatize. What they're really talking about doing is a couple of different things. They're talking about expanding that choice program, which currently is controlled by the VA and requires you to be 40 miles or further from a clinic or medical center. Or it requires that if you have an appointment that is going to be 30 days or more out, that you have to be offered the option of choice. You do not have to accept that choice program. However, what they're intending to do is expand that choice and take away any or most restrictions on the use of it. So consequently, if I wanted to go to my private care, I'd go to my private care doctor, and then I'd come back, and then the VA would have to pay for it. So the VA no longer has any control over it, and each dollar that goes out to private care is going to take a dollar away from care at the VA. And private care is typically has been researched to show that it's 30% higher than care at the VA. The VA is one of the reasons that they'd like to get rid of the VA, among others. Some people don't believe there should be any government programs, but the VA is actually a working model of national health care. It does function well. The RAND Corporation studied the VA's health care for 10 years, and they claimed the RAND Corporation, which I don't consider any sort of a liberal entity, said that in their estimation in studying the various factors that are utilized to determine care out in the world, that VA equals or exceeds private care outcomes. The New England Journal of Medicine has also stated that VA quality of care is significantly better than private sector Medicare. And the British Medical Journal has lauded the VA for offering more equitable care of higher quality at comparable or lower cost than private sector alternatives. Now, those are endorsements by entities within the field and or respected outside of, should be outside of the fray. But I would say that the thing that we need to take a look at is how did we get here? Well, as quickly as I can, back in 2011, the VA was facing long wait times because they had lots of soldiers coming back from the wars, and they had not enough staff available. Funding was not ready for a war. It was the same way when we came back from Vietnam. So they instituted at that time the requirement that veterans had to be seen within a two-week time period if they were being seen for a first time of authorized care. So then you fast forward to 2014, you've got Phoenix, where the CHOICE program got its boost from. And the problems down there with there were problems down in Phoenix, no doubt. They were playing with the records to make it look like they were meeting that two-week window that was required of them. But guess what happens down in Phoenix every winter? 25,000 snowbird veterans, elderly, sicker than most people in the population, are come down there and they want care. That VA was overwhelmed. So Congress saying, aha, let's institute a CHOICE program. It'll give options out there, but it'll also give us a foot in the door towards privatization. And I believe that that's what brought us to the point where we're at right now, Mike.
I can testify to a lot of veterans being in Phoenix, just having recently been down there. There are a lot of folks who decide to go down there because the weather is nice this time of year, obviously. Now, taxpayers have an interest in this because it lowers costs and ultimately what they have to pay. You're trying to get the word out beyond veterans, because you say within the veteran community, people pretty much understand the value of this, and you're trying to get this out to other taxpayers. You've got an event about that coming up this evening. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah. In Minneapolis this evening at 7:30, the U.S. Air Force Band is going to be playing at the Ted Mann Concert Hall over at the U of M. And so we're going to be rallying in front of the Ted Mann Concert Hall at 6:30. And I thought it very appropriate. The military spends $437 million a year on military bands. $437 million on bands. Okay. I don't get that. But anyway, so we felt it was a perfect opportunity for us. Both members of the veterans community, Veterans for Peace, other veterans who choose to join us, and also some members of AFGE, who are the American Federation of Government Employees. Some of the people who work out at the VA will join us also. And so that's what we're looking forward to at the Ted Mann Concert Hall tonight. That's at 2128 4th Street South at the U of M at 6:30 this evening is when we will be rallying, Mike.
Okay, so a very short time from now.
Yeah.
If people, if they missed all that information, are you on Facebook or any place that there's an event that people can say I'm coming?
I believe that it should be on the local chapter's website, which is
Veterans for Peace.
VFP, standing for Veterans for Peace, VFPChapter27.org. And there should be information on that's available.
All right. VFPChapter27.org is where you should go. All right. Well,
and also if people are really looking for, if there's other veterans out there or other concerned citizens one of the primary sources in the country to go and get some information on this is fightingforveteranshealthcare.org. That's abbreviated to FFVHC.org. And that's a great site to keep up with things.
FFVHC.org is that other URL for you
Correct.
Folks. All right.
Thanks,
well, we've been speaking with David Cooley, Vietnam veteran and a member of Veterans for Peace. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Mike, it was my pleasure. You have a good evening. Take care now.
And coming up here next on the show, we're going to delve into a congressional district race that we don't hear much about, CD6, because that's always in the hands of Republicans. There's a Democrat who would like to change that, and he has about a week to have it make some impact. We'll talk about that next year on the Mike McEntee Show. Hey, it's Mike McEntee back with you here on AM 950. The Minnesota legislature is continuing to clunk along, heading towards a adjournment in late May. But a lot of issues are rearing their heads again, things that we thought maybe were dead, but they're coming back to life, as things tend to do in the legislature. You can't count a bill out. Now, Representative Steve Drazkowski, somebody that you've probably heard about before, Republican, he wants another preemption bill. This one, he'd like cities and counties to be penalized if they spend money to help immigrants defend themselves against deportation. That's right. If this city or county decides that they're going to give legal advice to somebody, they will end up losing money from the state. Now, Luce Maria Lopez Rosas testified about this. She tearfully told the committee that that bill is trying to dehumanize immigrants who do have rights.
I want to first and foremost reclaim my community's humanity. I hear that you've all been saying illegal immigrants. And they're not illegal because human beings cannot be illegal. They're still people. And I'm in tears because 11 years ago, 10 minutes away from here, at 732 Randolph Avenue, my mother was picked up by ICE. Thank you. They came into my home and they started pulling my mother away like she was a criminal. And it breaks my heart to hear that you are attempting to put us as second-class citizens like you did with slaves, because we have rights. And whether you like it or not, the truth is that we too pay taxes. So we have a say in how these taxes are used. They take them out of our paychecks, and we have ITIN numbers. We pay. We pay in this country, and we contribute millions of dollars here. I don't want to hear that this is only for citizens, because it's not. And I'm sorry that I'm in tears, but it breaks my heart because the political situation is so tense and stressful for our communities. This happened to me 11 years ago, and unfortunately, in one day in Tennessee, it happened to 500 children. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you about all the woes that came after that, but I want you to touch your hearts and think about, when you're talking about these kinds of things, you're talking about people. You're talking about affecting real life people. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Now, the argument Drazkowski made is that the local government shouldn't be helping people who are criminals. The thing is, they aren't criminals. Deporting somebody is a civil matter, and that's why the Department of Justice tries the cases. It's not a criminal matter. Those facts didn't sway Drazkowski or some of his fellow Republicans. There was no vote on this issue. The bill is laid over and may become part of another bill later. We've been talking about all the different races going on here in Minnesota. We've talked about the 8th Congressional District, where we had an announcement. We'll recap that in just a little bit here. But in the 6th Congressional District, the congressman is Tom Emmer, a Republican. And before that, it was Michelle Bachmann, also a Republican. The Republicans have had a grip on the district for more than a decade. So it's not the top of a lot of National Democrats' lists to flip this November, but Richard Kelly thinks it's possible, and he's making a run at it as a DFL candidate and joins us now. Hello, Richard. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for calling me. I appreciate it.
Good to have you on here. Now, you've got until this Saturday, I believe, to get enough support for the endorsement. The other candidate, Ian Todd's been running for the DFL endorsement for some time. You just announced a few weeks ago. How's it all going?
It's been going really good, better than I expected in some ways. In some ways, you know, it's good no matter what.
All right. Well, tell us first why you're running, because this is never something that somebody does just for the fun of it, usually.
I am running. I have a cause, and I am an expert in it, and it, hopefully it's not my only one. And I can win, and I am sincere in this. And Mr. Todd is a fine man. And if I don't get this, I will do anything he asks me. Better if he wins over this, better I get out of the way. But I go to fish fries and church dinners all over the town, country, state, world. So I'll do whatever he needs, and he doesn't need me.
Well, tell me about your issue. Tell me what's motivating you.
Well, a good look at the St. Cloud Times, March 1st of this year, would be a good place to start. And it's mental health is the one I'm referring to.
Okay.
But I'm not a one-trick pony, so it's all right.
Well,
and Mr. Emmer, I'm having a little barbecue, and I'm in Cold Spring, Minnesota now, a couple blocks from Plantenberg's, if I need to get some more meat. But he can come over today if he wants. I don't know if he would ever dream of it. I don't know if his paid sponsors would give him that much money to come and talk to me. I'll do any debate, anytime, any place, about anything. And please don't make me prep.
Okay, nothing like a little barbecue.
Instead. Sorry. I'm boasting now. I'm sorry. I'll listen to your questions, please.
Yeah, nothing like a little debate over some barbecue. Let's go back to mental health, because you said you are an expert
sure.
in that area. What makes you an expert in that area?
Well, on April 1st of this year, Easter, I celebrated my 35th year working with Stearns County Human Services clients. Not only with them, of course, every county around, and most in the state and around the country, but most of them are from right here, home. So if there's any doubt of that. Also, since in my own business I've started, it's been, I don't know, what was it, 1991, I think, I bought my first house of my own to do foster care. I've never had 1 minute of paid time off. I don't get insurance. I don't get vacation, 501c3, Roth IRAs. But, you know, if part of your money isn't considered income, you got to work extra hard to get some that is, so you can even get a Roth IRA. And that smells like something farmers know right there. The things we have now for retirement accounts were the booby prize decades ago. But anyway, I think I've touched on enough issues to let people think. I will speak more or less, but sometimes you don't have to speak if you've lived it.
Mm-hmm.
I've been on both sides of many issues, and especially, not even especially, but I'll say especially the one I'm referencing about mental health. Because, you know, who doesn't need mental health care in this world? I know a few that I want to target if I'd given the opportunity. But, you know, I'm an expert. I have a cause, and I'm an expert in it.
I think after the last couple of years of politics, a lot of people would like a mental health break, I think, is maybe one way of looking at this. Let's
you
talk
know,
about the mental. Go ahead.
I was going to say, take it if you need it. Know when you need it. No, because if you're going to commit suicide and you don't, you know you don't need it. You're just screaming for help. And there's nobody listening, it seems. Sometimes it's almost apparent. You have to run and run. You have to set your hair on fire, and no one will pour their coffee out over you, decaf even. It seems like. So if there's anyone who needs to hear that, please be listening.
Yeah, and I was making light there, but obviously it's a very serious issue. When you look
you
at the mental health system.
You have to make light, because serious does not mean you can't be funny.
Okay.
I'm done with that.
When you look at the mental health system that we have, obviously there's a lot of problems. What would you as a congressman be able to do to improve that?
Well, keep watching. I don't want to take all of your time. I don't want to use all of your time, but things can be done. If you can do them yourself, I'm a farm kid, fifth generation, wanted to be the sixth. But the 1970s took care of that. It was a rough decade after the 60s, I suppose. We had one good man, and there's more than one good man or woman around. And when I say man, that's not gender specific. But there is a good man, and I wish to shake his hand someday. And I lost a mother this morning. Anyway.
Oh, dear.
Anyway.
I-
It's serious.
I'm so sorry to
hear. I'm not always serious. I'm not smiling, but I'm always deadly serious. And I'll do what people need me to do or ask me to do. I can go home. I got meat in the car. I got meat in the car. My friends and family are waiting. I don't know. But I'm ready for whatever I'd be asked of.
Well, my condolences on your mother. I'm so sorry to hear.
Well, it's the mother to the world. She was for a while, and she had a beautiful blue dress and gleaming white hair. And I do feel sorry, too, for all of us, especially her family and her home. Thank you. What else? You I can answer anything. Let me know right now or anytime.
Okay, well, let's let you. We've hit on, I think,
answer
what
I know. Excuse me. I don't have all the answers, but I got some.
What are the other issues that are motivating you? Obviously, we talked about the big one, but what else do you see that differentiates between you and Tom Emmer here?
Well, you know, I know my dad was in something called a brotherhood, and I don't, you know, and please refer back always when I say that. I don't want to have to catch myself that much that brotherhood, sisterhood is not, it's not gender specific. And I've known a lot of women who are the men of their families, and that's a compliment. So please, please don't make me have to, I'll repeat that because I do automatically, but please don't make me anyone. It's, I want to talk how it's people talk. So how I learned at least. And so unions would be a huge one.
Unions. Okay.
Well, so many of these things are overlapping. When I learned the word Boolean logic, the bubbles that stick together and where you overlap, you do it. So isn't it all connected? You know, and if anybody thinks that it's easy to smile these days, well, you can vote for Emmer then. I encourage it. I wish he would drop out of the damn race so we didn't have to waste our time and money on this. If anyone wants to smile at him, you go right ahead. I won't think any less. I plan on never asking anybody for a vote. Because that's begging. It's not when you need to do. You can hang your head in pride if you need to, because that's what a grown man does.
So and you're not going to ask.
I don't want to be too tough on the radio and stuff for you, but I'll answer what you need.
Yeah, go back to that. You said you're not going to ask anybody to vote for you. Then how are you going to get people to vote for you? How are you going to win this endorsement that's coming up this Saturday and then go on to beat Tom Emmer if you're not asking people to vote for you?
You know, I said I love questions. I especially love rhetorical questions.
Okay, I guess we'll classify that one as one of them. So,
I'm not smart enough. I just went to St. Cloud State, and everybody knows. Oh, we just went to St. Cloud State. I hate that place. No, that I won't even say that out loud. I hope not again. But you know, they taught an Irishman how to read, and that's why I'm different than my dad. He could read, but anyway. Don't go to your family. Don't use your family. You know you can use them, but don't. And education.
So, Richard, if people in the 6th Congressional District, especially those who are DFL delegates, are listening to this right now, where could they go to find more information about you and your campaign and maybe some of the details on your platform? Do you have a website out there right now, or is it just pretty much running to you at the convention?
I have a Facebook page.
Okay.
It was my own Facebook page, unredacted, and everything, every keystroke, every word I did. And I used my own unredacted. I didn't take nothing out of it. And I've added to it. And I went from 50-some friends to 1,700 last I looked a few days ago. And I did that two or three days. You know, the thing is, I don't have to remember it because if it's recorded, it can be found. So you don't have to clutter yourself with that. You might still remember. You don't have to clutter yourself with that if it's recorded. And we all know if it wasn't recorded, it didn't happen, for good or for bad.
Okay. Well, then,
Being too opaque, I hope, because I'll answer questions. I'm not full of bullshit. And if I could talk in my voice of the rest of the farmers on Rural Route 1, Annandale, not even Annandale, suburban West Albion, if you can find that on a map. But there were some good farmers in the 1940s there, too, some fine Finlanders, and I won't even go the real words, but fine Finnish people there. They can be looked up in that line, too. Everett Hadayarvi is a good old one, and Usti Madala. And Jake and Alice Hoyka, and I could go on and on and on and on. They were my playmates when I was a kid. The bookmobile, when we got to South Haven, we got to that. But then again, we had to walk 2 miles back and forth. If you had a bike, that's good, too. But anyway.
Well, Richard, we're out.
What else can I answer for you?
Well, we're out of time here, but Richard, people can look you up on Facebook. The DFL convention is this coming Saturday on the 21st, and we appreciate your time today.
Thank you. Richard E. Kelly, or Richard Edward, I believe it's on there. That was my grandpa Liesel's middle name, first name. And he died when my mom was pregnant with me before I come. So I appreciate it. Call me anytime or contact. It's not that I don't see you and listen and wouldn't. I just might not always have time to respond. But I mean, with fine folks like you in this great media we have of our country, that even in Europe, I've been told by people who would know off the cuff, and that's Europe, I mean, friends of ours, where we all came from who are pasty white Irish bohemians like me.
All right. Richard Kelly, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
All right. We're going to take a break here, folks. And when we get back, got a couple stories I want to update you on. One from yesterday, we were talking about that big screw-up that the IRS made. We got some updates on that, as well as a case that's been pending in Minnesota Supreme Court for some time. That's all next year on the Mike McEntee Show.
Time to fire up Minnesota with a smoking hot grill from Warner Stellion. Finally, it's Grill Expo weekend, which means new gas, charcoal, pellet, and smoker grills are fired up so you can witness their awesomeness. Choose your favorite and buy at Warner Stellion's lowest price of the year. Then get free assembly, free delivery and recycling, 18 months zero interest financing, and three free products from no-name butcher quality meats and seafood. Don't miss the fun. Grill Expo this weekend at Warner Stellion.
Seward Co-op, serving the community for nearly 45 years, invites you to shop their two convenient locations, both offering the strong commitment to local producers and healthy foods you've come to expect. Seward focuses on locally grown and raised products, fair trade, and environmental sustainability. Shop their selection of meats, artisan cheeses, and house-made baked goods. Find Seward at 2823 East Franklin Avenue or the Friendship Store on 38th Street and 3rd Avenue in Minneapolis. More at seward.coop.
This is Dan Brooks, Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor with RBC Wealth Management. For the past 19 years, I've been managing wealth for individuals, institutions, and corporate retirement plan sponsors. Throughout my career, I have seen common traits in successful investors. They include the courage to be diversified, the willingness to work with a professional, the discipline to follow a plan, and patience. I welcome the opportunity to help contribute to your financial success. Call me at 612-371-2396.
Minnesota is home to the only major institution in North America devoted to Russian art, history, and culture. The Museum of Russian Art, located off 35W on Diamond Lake Road in South Minneapolis, can be your personal connection to extraordinary artists, stories, and context. We offer more exhibitions and events than ever before, from concerts and lectures to vodka tastings and more. Open daily, free parking, and a great Groupon deal. Find out more at tmora.org.
Hey, welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. A couple updates I want to get to you here real quickly. Remember yesterday we were talking about that massive mess on the IRS site that the glitch was preventing people from paying their taxes. Well, some good news. The Minnesota individual and business taxpayers affected by the IRS e-filing system issues will not be assessed late filing and payment penalties or interest if they file or pay by midnight tonight. So taxpayers do not need to do anything to receive this extra time. A little bit of good news there if you are one of the people kind of caught in the mess on that. We were talking about mental health here during this last interview just a few minutes ago. Gary from Minneapolis wanted to weigh in on that. Hi, Gary. How are you today?
Well, I'm not crying just about mental health. All existing illnesses and even people that aren't sick take on the drug and insurance cartels that are such a burden to all of us. Even people with good health are burdened with this high cost of health insurance, and get them cartels off our back and get a Medicare-type insurance for everybody like the rest of the world. They don't control the – look at all the bankruptcies we have and look at the cost it is to our society and all the unnecessary suffering that goes on with these powerful money they have, and they keep getting more and more. The greed don't stop.
Yeah, the whole idea of the Obamacare was to take away and get rid of a lot of bankruptcies, and so far that seemed to be the case. Yeah, it was a start, and obviously it's being undermined. I just hope that doesn't come back, because that was one of the big benefits of that. It really was. Hey, Gary, I appreciate the comment on that. Thank you so much. The other breaking story I wanted to talk about this afternoon real quickly is this case that's been going on between State Auditor Rebecca Otto and the counties. It's been a case really over her constitutional duties. The Minnesota Supreme Court today ruled against State Auditor Rebecca Otto, and it ends the long effort to block a 2015 law that allows counties to hire outside of counties accountants, than her office. Now, Otto, who's running for governor, had argued that the law undermined her authority. She sued Becker and Wright counties after they hired CPA firms and challenged Ramsey County's refusal to sign a three-year contract, ensuring that her office had the sole right to conduct audits. This is really about defunding the state auditor's office, which was part of a bill that Governor Dayton did sign, but it was part of a bigger bill. And he's since then regretted that part of it, but he can't do anything to undo it. The justices today upheld rulings by a district court and the Minnesota Court of Appeals. They concluded that the law did not violate the separations of power clause in the Minnesota's Constitution, nor a clause requiring that the bills in the legislature deal with a single subject. And that's a big deal, because that's been one of the outcomes of the suit we've been waiting to hear, is if the single subject clause that's talked about will actually be imposed. Apparently not. And legislators can continue to shove as many things as they want to in one bill, and it won't make any difference. That's it for today's show. We'll be back tomorrow on Thursday. See you then. Mom, thanks for listening.